Coming up on this episode of Greyhound Nation, veterinarian and researcher Dr. Rob Gillette sits down to talk with John about Greyhound sports medicine. Stay tuned. The Nation is next. This is Greyhound Nation, episode 30, recorded August 2nd, 2022. Dr. Rob Gillette on Greyhound sports medicine. Greyhound Nation is a podcast for Greyhound enthusiasts produced by Greyhound enthusiasts. To learn more about our show and its hosts, visit our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. Welcome to another episode of the Greyhound Nation podcast. I'm Michael Burns. Now, here's your host, John Parker.
Welcome back, Greyhound lovers, to the best Greyhound podcast in the world. Our guest for this episode is Dr. Rob Gillette, who I've known quite a few years. He's had a lot of involvement with Greyhounds in sports medicine, and he's got a lot of information and background to share with us. So, Rob, welcome.
Well, thanks so much for having me, John. This is a lot of fun getting to work with you again.
Let's go back. I always, with our guests, want a little bio, and I know our listeners are always interested in somebody's educational background, their Greyhound background, et cetera. Tell us a little bit about where you're from originally, and also where you got your veterinary degree and so forth.
Sure. I was born and raised in western Kansas in a town called Great Bend, Kansas, which is right next to or right up by Cheyenne Bottoms. And if anybody knows racing history, they know that the first coursing meet was held at Cheyenne Bottoms. It was related to the National Greyhound Coursing Association. So I have that little claim to fame there, although I didn't know it at the time where I was growing up. I grew up hunting with a bird dog named Ben and a retriever named Adrian. And I would say that I didn't really understand the athleticism of the dogs I worked with. Then I went to veterinary school at Kansas State University. I graduated in 88, but while I was there, one summer I was working for a practice out in Littleton, Colorado, and went up to the dog track and met the track veterinarian there, Dr. Earl Carlson, and he took me to the backside. And once that greyhound put his head on my leg, I said, man, I would love to work with these guys. And so I started a path or course towards learning more about greyhounds. I've always been more of a fringe player in the greyhound world. There's certainly major people that know so much and so devoted to the sport, the industry, the breed. I kind of poke my head in sometimes, learn some stuff, provide some information, then kind of get back out for a while. But it's not that I don't love them, because I really do. And when I got out of veterinary school, I was living in the Kansas City area and taking care of some of the dogs up the dog track and some of the breeders in the Kansas City area and in the Abilene area, and thought, well, maybe I should understand what my clientele is going through. So I partnered up on a female named Kiowa Germany, and that was my first portal into the greyhound world. She was a great dog. We had a few pups out of her. I got to be a very good adoption dog raiser, and not necessarily the greatest raiser of the elite level greyhound athletes, but I loved it every bit of the time I was there. I then went to the University of Kansas while I was working there, and got a postdoc in human performance sports medicine and exercise physiology, and applied all that stuff from the human side and put it into the greyhound. Our goal at the time, I actually received the first research grant given out by the Kansas Racing Commission to look at understanding how greyhounds run and the potential for reducing racing injuries at the time. That was the start of it all, John. And at some point, I think it was 97, I moved down to Auburn University, was on faculty there for 15 years, and that's where I met you and got introduced to more worlds of stuff. It was a great time down there. Now, so that's my introduction.
There you go. That's pretty darn good. Was it during that in the 90s then that you were when you were working with the Racing Commission, did you do some work on research on track surfaces and how they related to injuries or absence of injuries?
Yeah, that's what's really kind of cool about my experiences in the Greyhound world is I've learned through the Greyhound, it's expanded out to many different areas, whether it's sled dogs or foxhounds or the military dogs. There's a little bits of things that I learned early when I was working with the Greyhounds that have ended up being benefits in other areas of the dog world from a performance standpoint. I was lucky enough to interact with Keith Dillon and in a group of the Phelan brothers. They introduced me to Greyhounds and to the elite athleticism of the dogs. And that's really kind of a flip for a veterinarian. A veterinarian, a lot of times, will see a dog after there's an injury or a sickness or an illness. And so to learn the what I call the left side of the event, the area where you're trying to find ways to optimize the ability of the dog, results in actually a reduction in injuries, results in a reduction of the sicknesses and the illnesses. And so my focus initially started on the racing surface and track design, bankings of the turns. We did a lot of work back in the days. Still do a lot. I did some consulting around the country with different racetracks back in the 90s and 2000s and 2010s. I've somehow always kind of kept my foot in the door there. But yeah, racing surfaces. And it's so interesting to me, John, is because when I look at other breeds, other dogs from a veterinary standpoint, and I'm thinking of lameness or rehabilitation related to injuries, I always ask the owner, like, what's your surface at home? You know, is it a hardwood floor? Is it a carpeted floor? What kind of backyard do you have? Because everything I learned from the Greyhound tells me that that paw to surface impact has a huge effect on the musculoskeletal system of the dog. So yeah, the racing surface, the paw to surface interaction, those were some of the earliest research I did. Yeah.
Well, delve back. I know this was a long time ago, but delve back into your memory bank for us and give us some little gems that you learned about racing surface at the track in terms of depth and composition and so forth.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny you mention that, John, because if we think about a racing surface, you know, we're trying to design a surface like you would a shoe for a human. And you want the surface to provide absorption from the impact. At the same time, you want the surface to provide traction. For those of us that our dogs run in fields, I guess what I'm getting at is we certainly, from a racing industry standpoint, wanted to have the safest surface. And that's key. That's important. Because that's showing how much effort the industry put into the safety of the dogs. If you look at the percentages of injuries in the racing greyhound compared to many other sports, they're minuscule. I mean, I think if I remember right, they were 0.8% or maybe 1%. When you look at youth sports, they're around 30%. So, you know, I bring up comments like that, and it's not to compare or say one's right or wrong. It's just that there was a lot of effort put in there. Now, that said, when I have my dogs run around in the backyard or in the fields, or we go out, you know, someplace where they run, I can't say that that surface was designed for them. But understanding that foot-to-surface contact has allowed me to better understand the stresses and the forces upon the paw or the musculoskeletal system of not only the greyhound, but retrievers, bird dogs, herding dogs, military dogs. That impact, those impacts actually have an effect on the dog. And if you prepare that, if you train to prepare the structure for those types of stressors or forces, all dogs benefit from that. Not just the greyhounds, but the pets. Any dog benefits from that. And I learned that from understanding how the greyhound works.
What about banking? What did you find was the optimum degree of banking on the track in the turns?
Well, that's kind of funny, John, because if you know, if you go with a NASCAR type banking, or you got like a almost like a 45 degree, that's the forces that the dog really needs as it's going around a turn. But the banking is dependent, and I know you're going to love this part because this gets into physics. There's centrifugal force, centripetal forces, and so the banking of the turn is somewhat different depending on the diameter. Or the radius of the turn. I mean, Lincoln track up in Rhode Island had a very tight turn. You go to the tracks in Texas, they developed a very big diameter turn. They actually had a very high bank in Texas. Sometimes when you started to manage the banks at these different levels, you ran into OSHA rules, like a tractor working the track can't be on a certain angle of track. So, because it increased the insurance costs related to that. So, and then the other thing that kind of came along is as we went to as they designed the bigger tracks and the higher banking, the bigger dogs could hold it when they couldn't have held it before. And so in some of those areas, you saw a shift in the types of dogs that would run at the different tracks. You always had a variation throughout the United States of dogs designed for different tracks. But you saw there in the late 80s, 90s, where some of the bigger dogs started to run different. And I defer to the guys that ran and managed dogs at the tracks. You know, again, I say I was a fringe player. Those guys really knew that stuff better than I did.
You know, it's a question I've always had, Rob, is when they actually built the track, you were talking about the difference in the tightness of the turns or maybe I remember at Derby Lane, the home stretch was a little bit longer. Who did these track management folks consult with in deciding, okay, we're going to have a tighter turn or we're going to have a longer home stretch or whatever it might be? Was it just based on how much land they had to deal with and to fit the track within the confines of the venue, or were they actually consulting with veterinarians or people that were like, your expertise?
Well, in the early days, they would fit a track in somewhere, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. The big thing is, when it comes to track design, I was talking with Dr. Payne over in England the other day. In a lot of cases, the bank's not necessarily important if the turn's wide enough, because you can see a shift in how the dog goes around the turn. But to your point, I think early they fit tracks into environments. The Americans wanted a longer stretch to kind of mimic the horse racing. Whereas you look at England and Australia and the other countries, the home stretch or the straightaways aren't quite as long. And so it's really a different race than it is over here. But the Americans kind of liked this long straightaway that they got with the Greyhounds. And again, I would defer, to the race people for that. But initially they were putting tracks into places. And then when I kind of came along in the late 80s, 90s, so much science went into the design of the track. But it was still, a construction company coming in and architects and who had to work with the design of the surface. I later started working quite a bit with Dr. Mick Peterson. I think he is at the University of Kentucky now, and he's done quite a bit of great work with the racing surfaces and the horse. But we met, I think it was in 2000, at the Racetrack Industry Program conference in Arizona. And it was just funny because we'd been doing parallel work at the same time. I was trying to develop an instrument that could be placed on the track to measure impacts. And he was doing a similar thing, only he was a real engineer, and so he knew how to build the equipment. I just had this theory in a box, and he laughed at me. He said, if I was to put that on the track, Rob, that would flip out of the stadium. And I said, okay, I get it. So it was fun working with him. They've really taken that a long ways. And in the United States, and I shouldn't say that, across the world, the Australians, the Brits, the Irish, they've put a lot of effort into racing safety, mostly because, it's all about the sport and it's about the safety of the dog. It's, You want to have equal racing, you know, cross the dogs so that, you know, each one has a fair chance to win. I mean, it's all about fairness and safety, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's move on to when your time at Auburn. That's where you and I first met. Tell us a little bit about how you came to be at Auburn and what position that you you took.
Yeah, so back in 97, me and Diana and Brad and a dog named Germs, that same brood female that I'd started out with, we hopped in a U-Haul and we went down to Auburn University. I'd taken a position as with the Scott Ritchie Research Institute, and I worked under Dr. Steve Swaim, where we did a lot of wound healing and reconstructive surgery, but I still had greyhounds. You know, at that time I started running them in Birmingham, in Montgomery. We had some running in the Florida tracks. I wanted to keep them kind of close so that we could go see them. Although it's funny because when I go see them, I really couldn't watch them run. I had to step out. Diana would stay in there and she'd come out and tell me, because I was just, and it was a lot of emotion when you watch your dog run. And
yeah, absolutely.
And so we moved down there and I got introduced to a whole new world that I had not really seen in Kansas. You know, I knew the bird hunting world, the bird dogs. I knew the greyhounds, knew some about retrievers. But I got down there, got introduced to the foxhounds and the coonhounds and the lurchers and a whole other world of you know, and the plantation dogs. That was really so cool to go in there and watch, you know, these dogs work, and got introduced to that. And through was that the NGA that I think you and I met? Not NGA, the AG Southeast.
The GPA. I believe we had you up to speak at the GPA convention in Atlanta.
That's right. That's right. And I think I had to leave in the middle of the lecture because there was a dog crashing in Auburn. I had to drive back. So I apologize, John.
We forgave you.
Yeah, up to that point, I had worked with Elaine Schultz out of the Southwest Missouri Adoption. And we had raised a few litters, and she was kind enough, and she was great to find homes for them. But I, at some point, Diana and I went down there to a meet the owner picnic. And I'm sorry, I'm digressing back to the Kansas days, but I went down there, and all my puppies, who were now, you know, 2 or 3 years, all ran up to me, and it was such a emotional, tough time. I said, Diana, I can't, and she was the same way. We can't do this anymore. So we quit raising dogs, and we moved to where we would look for, you know, 1-year-old or 18-month-old dogs and go that route. I got down, and that's how I met you, is because I was associated with the American Greyhound Adoption Group and all that, and that's how I came to interact with you.
Yeah. Now, you ultimately at Auburn started the sports medicine department. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was, so as a continuation of my earlier work, I developed a working athletic dog lab there. And it was great because as one of my greyhounds would retire from the track, we'd bring him into the veterinary school there. And I had, they were maintained very well. We had some fields in the back area where I could, they got to run either twice a week or once a week, depending on the time in between we wanted to rest them. And it was just like, I don't know how to describe heaven for a dog, but for these guys, you know, they were doing everything they wanted to do. I mean, it's hard for a lot of people to understand how driven and how much these greyhounds love to run and how much they love to chase something. And that was what was kind of cool about that, John, is that, you know, we had the veterinary students there who had never seen anything like this before. And we'd take them out and, you know, they would hold on to one of these greyhounds who were running to let go, you know, who's running to run. And they had to understand how to hold them. And that's the one comment that I would get from them as they would get through with their week or 2 weeks they were with us. I just didn't understand the energy in these dogs. And So we had that, and then we also had I had six bird dogs. So I had sprint animals and I had endurance dogs there, and the students would get to play with them. Well, they were learning. I don't mean play with them, but it was a nice opportunity. The freshmen would come out and work with them, and they'd get to touch dogs. Then the seniors would come out and learn more from a medical standpoint, and that's what's kind of neat about that. So much came out of that. We put heart rate monitors on them, and I don't know if you remember this or not, but I would take a temperature, a pulse, and a respiration. Then we'd go down, we'd set up, I'd show them the lure, so they'd know where the lure was, and then we'd hand slip them, and they would run, anywhere from 75 to 200 yards. And then we would pull them over, and we'd take a temperature, pulse, and respiration. And what was kind of interesting was that, after they ran, we always saw this increase in heart rate and temperature, which was really hadn't been documented too much. I think Phil Toll and Pichel had written a paper a little bit about it, where they had done some stuff on a track, but this was really kind of unheard of at the time. I've always been a little ahead of the curve. so we did that. And then I had this heart rate monitor, and we put this heart rate monitor on when they run. And it was so, it just kind of blew me away. We walked the Greyhound down there, we ran the Greyhound, and then we looked at the data later, and the heart rate was actually faster and higher when the Greyhound saw the lure than from the run itself. That was a shift. That was a shift really in thinking about the excitement of the performance dog. I mean, they always, we always kind of like, we'll take the dog out there. And it's and there's so many dogs that are affected by this excitement, whether it's a Greyhound or a retriever but we really saw it in the Greyhound. The Greyhound, they certainly have this, I guess you call it prey drive, whatever it is, but it's an excitement. Actually got a very nice paper out of that, published research article out of that data.
Yeah, remember you're telling me about that, and I think I actually read the paper, and it changed the way that when I was running my Greyhounds in lure coursing, and still to this day, I try to keep them out of sight of the lure before they run, so that the heart rate is not so high, and they're not heating up and so forth, even on a nice winter day. And so it's been my practice, and I've encouraged other people to do this, to get behind a vehicle or the equipment trailer.
But not under the vehicle, by a muffler.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's people that would put them under a vehicle, but it's a little too close to the muffler.
Yes,
you don't want to do that.
But that I just found that really fascinating. Do you think that enhances that increased heart rate before they run when they see the lure enhances performance or decreases it?
Well, and that's funny because John, and you guys know Greyhounds very well, or sighthounds. We could even take it out to sighthounds because they all have that drive or that excitement. There's a diversity. Some of them are crazy. Some of them are not. I had a little dog. What was her name? When they would put her in the starting box, she'd start bouncing around. She was so excited that about half the time, Casey will win. Half the time, the box would open and she'd be backwards, and they could never get her. Even when they would try to put an extra wall in her to make the box smaller, they could never get her from bouncing around in the crates or in the starting box. So you have this, and I saw that. We had a little. When we were doing that study, we had a little dog named Hannah, and Hannah was just hard to hold her. Now, it was lucky she was only like a 50-pound Greyhound. Then we had another one that was like an 80-pound Greyhound that was just nuts. Then we had a couple of them that they just kind of walk out there, and then when you get ready to hand slip them, it would turn on, and then it'd turn off. So you do have a diversity, but you have to – I think the key to it, John, is to understand it could be there, and some of these dogs have that. And if I'm worried about overheating, if I'm worried about performance, all that, I need to find a way to manage that and adapt my management of that dog for that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've had a couple of Greyhounds over the years that are just cool as cucumbers.
Sorry.
In the waiting to run. They just walk to slips like it was just another day at the office. No barking, no carrying on. And boy, when that lure moved, the game was on, and they wasted no energy in the paddock. You know, they just went, they walked in a stately manner to the slips and off they went. And those are my favorite kind to have because they required much less management. You know, you didn't have to worry about them overheating or barking too much and leaving all their energy in the paddock. But they're pretty far, few and far between. I've found most of the greyhounds I've had, you know, they get very excited once they see that lure or even seeing the other dogs run on a course. So,
well, and that's a good point.
That is valuable research for sure.
Well, that's kind of interesting, John. I wanted to make a quick comment on that because this excitement that we see in the greyhounds, you know, it's something that they just truly actually, they'll actually change their physiology. The metabolism changes related to that excitement. And that's what we picked up in the data we were collecting. But it's funny because that led to some other things. Like when we were developing the military dogs for the Iraq war, Afghanistan war, those dogs had that same excitement to do things. But we knew how to address it, how to manage it, how to look after it or look for it because of what we'd learned from the greyhounds.
Yeah, it truly is amazing the amount of knowledge, information has come out of research on greyhounds that was then used to benefit other dogs.
Yeah, and I hate to say research on greyhounds because that has a really negative connotation to it. But because everything we were doing was letting the dogs do whatever they wanted, and then we would just we just acquire data while they were doing it. So
yeah,
it was a very positive program I had there at Auburn.
I can remember when you were at Auburn when we'd bring a dog down for you kind of mystery lameness or a bad toe or whatever, and we're going to get into toes in a second. I'd come down with the dog, and one of the benefits of the drive, at making that drive, was you'd always take me out to wherever the research was going on with the greyhounds, and there was always something different. It was really cool. I tell us about some other research tests you did with greyhounds involving running.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of cool. So one of the things I wanted to understand, because I had figured out the biomechanics of what optimized speed, if you will, in a greyhound, we realized that the conditioning the back muscles was important related to a sprint speed. We realized that over the length of a race or a course, whatever it is, that there's actually fatigue of the digital muscles, whereas the foot does this, right? And if you feel your just distal to your elbow, you got muscles in there. Well, these greyhounds and dogs are impacting that all the time, and just the distance of a quarter mile to a little farther in that, or whatever mile or distance they're running, whether they're out in the field, those muscles will fatigue itself. And when the dog first takes off, they're very taut because they're tight. And they go through this, what we call eccentric contraction, where the muscles are trying to contract at the same time they're elongating. And that will put some fatigue on it. And as they, it creates a spring effect. And the spring effect actually is positive because it kind of pops the leg up and goes through. The same thing in the vertebral muscles through the glutes down through the leg and through the stifle to the hocks, you get this same spring effect. It's a coil effect, and as they stretch it, it pops up. But as they fatigue, you start to lose that. And once they start to kind of get into that fatigue state, they're actually having to work harder because they've lost that that spring effect. And that's also kind of the time where we could be more predisposed to injury, although it's the greyhounds are so well designed, really, to minimize injury. I mean, if you think about all the dogs that run around at an event, and it's a rarity when someone actually gets injured. You know, when you look at the number of dogs, and that's one thing that I learned that I could take back into a pet population is that if you conditioned and trained and worked the dog, the structure was actually stronger, and we reduced the amount of lameness and injuries in a pet population. We got so many dogs out there that are really kind of couch potatoes and not doing anything because we're scared they'll get hurt. Well, you have to introduce, there's actually Wolf's Law and Davis's Law. There are a couple of exercise physiological theorems that the bones will form their shape according to the forces placed upon them. And Davis's Law is a corollary where the muscles and the soft tissues are the same. And so if you don't do anything, you actually get this atrophy of loss of structure. And so you really need exercise to build the structure and strengthen it up. And that's what's kind of cool about a greyhound, because it's always kind of there in that breed.
Yeah.
So that's another thing we learned related to the running.
One thing I've always debated with, and it's a debate carried on in the sighthound community at large for amateur sports like lure coursing and racing, is warm up, the best method of warm up. Some people take the dogs out and let them trot alongside them. Some do stretching exercises. In your experience, what's the optimum warm up technique before they run a lure course?
Yeah,
an oval.
That's funny because I graduated from high school in 1977. When you're like, how'd Rob go down this path? But when I was a freshman at Kansas State in my undergrad, my PE paper, I had to do a research paper, was on why should you warm up or not. And that's always stuck with me ever since then. You know, you want to warm up the muscles that are going to be used. You know, when you go out and, you know, try to touch your toes and stretch your hamstrings and all these stuff, and you do these kind of fast jerk types of stretches, they realize that's not necessarily beneficial for the muscles that are as you go into the performance. And so a light movement, the jogging, the trotting, any of the stretching they're doing, they're not really doing any of these high strain stretches with the greyhounds. But what's kind of funny about that, John, if I wanted to actually debate myself, which happens a lot with the voices in my head, is that when you look at the Thompson's Gazelle, and who's getting chased by the cheetah, they don't do stretches before they take off. They just take off and go, you know? So there are many of those where you can kind of get in a discussion. Well, do they need to be warmed up? I think they do, you know, at the track, you know, they were trotted up and down the paraded. And that really helped kind of stimulate some of the blood supply, the blood flow and all that, warmed the, and there's these interfascial planes that need to be kind of warmed up so that the hyaluronic acid between them is moving smoothly. And that kind of type of activity, I think, is great for warming them up. Then when they get done, you really kind of need to walk them around and let them cool down, or whatever you want to call them, when they get done. It's almost as important as the warming up before.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I see in cold weather climates when there's racing, they seem to put the rugs, as they call them, coats back on them fairly quickly. And I've always wondered, maybe they should leave them off a little while, because of that core temperature that the greyhounds built up, maybe whether they need to walk a little while and to cool down before they put the coat back on. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's what's kind of cool as well, because, when we were doing the greyhounds, we actually realized that, so when I was working with dogs, again, my mom said, you know, Rob kind of marches to the beat of a different drummer. And I've always kind of been this way. When I was working the dog tracks in Kansas City, if a dog came off hot, and we knew they're hot, and we'd have to use a dairy thermometer to get the temperature because it would go above what the thermometer would have, we'd throw them in a tank of ice water and to cool them down real quick. And it always worked. I never had a dog overheat. Now, that's not a very good scientific term. Of all the dogs I worked with, we rarely had a dog overheat coming off the track. And in the summer, we get pretty hot temperatures there. But there were some papers that came out in the veterinary world where they said you should not do that because there's a shift in how the blood supplies, and you're keeping the blood actually in the core, where it's doing some damage. And it took me a while to figure out what was going on there. What I realized is it's a time factor, John. When the dogs came off the track, we were cooling them. Sometimes we'd see temperatures up to 109 degrees. I mean, And that, and later when I was working sled dogs, we realized those guys are reaching temperatures of 108, 109 commonly. I don't say commonly, but it's not rare while they're running. Theoretically, those are medically emergency levels of body temperature. But we'd get them off like that. It was a time thing. They were only exposed to that temperature within 30 seconds, maybe a minute or two. As opposed to a veterinarian who's in a practice where a dog overheats somewhere, gets put in a car and is driven somewhere. Now they're a half hour, hour into it at that same high body temperature. And if you relate that to sticking, you know, some liver in the oven, if I stick a slice of liver in the oven at 150 degrees for 30 seconds, it won't, well, 10 seconds, it wouldn't really do anything to liver. But if I leave it in there for 30 minutes or an hour, It's not only a temperature, it's a duration of time that is exposed to that temperature. I think the real reason that when they put the coats on right after the race is you have such a flow of heat coming off that body, and the temperature is so cold outside that you need to keep that heat in. And those coats aren't on for a long period of time, only to get the dog, you know, from the track to the kennel or to the truck, and then they're taken off. So I see your point there, but I don't think that's really a major factor.
That's good. Well, let's talk a second about, more than a few seconds, about greyhound toes, the bane of every greyhound owner's existence, whether they're involved in sports or not. I've known as many people that have had greyhound sprain or dislocate a toe in the backyard running around as I have running and lure coursing or racing. So let's talk about just kind of the physiology of sprains and dislocations. What happens when a greyhound does that to its toe?
Well, and that goes back to the work with surfaces. You know, if you've got a long toenail, right, and you're running on grass or turf or sod type of surface, that nail can go into the surface. Now that nail is stuck in place there, but that nail is not like a cleat on a football shoe or a golf shoe or whatever. It's actually attached to the third phalanx or the bones in the toe. And so when that toe goes over, the foot turns. It's just part of the natural movement. So now you're putting torsional forces on those digits, the toes, and those are the forces that create these problems. You know, I don't want to say we didn't see it on a racing surface at a track, because in sand, the feet go in and the feet move a little bit. But when you get on sod or grass type surfaces, the nails and the pads get great grip. It's great traction. You want it. By the hands, it does can predispose those distal extremities to problems. And my experience with toes, and it's not always the toe, John, you got to understand that the digital flexors and extensors are attached to those toes. So the toes really are an extension of this muscle and tendon. And I, from understanding that in greyhounds, has led me to have a vast understanding of lameness in dogs in the general population. Because actually it happens to a lot of pet dogs, but it's not enough to create clinical significance. You and your greyhound, the typical greyhound owners are so in tune with their dogs, they'll pick up if there's just a little thing going on with their toe. Most pet owners don't quite pick it up. Yeah, my dog was a little gimpy for a few days last week, but now it's doing good. He gets back up on the couch. If all a greyhound had to do is get on a couch, you know, then you probably wouldn't notice it either. So the way that they are not necessarily more predisposed to it than other breeds, but we notice it because we see it. One, you know, there's not much hair around there. So we see if a joint is swollen. We see if there's a, you know, if they're kind of lightly holding it up. So you've got three bones in each toe. And those bones are held together by what we call ligaments. If anybody's played volleyball or basketball, they've probably jammed a finger. It's very similar to what happens to dogs and or we could say greyhounds, if you will, that these toes get injured a lot. And I shouldn't say a lot of injuries. They can occur. And so if it's just a sprain, that's one thing. You can usually manage it going forward. If it's actually a dislocation where the ligament is ruptured and we have a displacement of the joint, it takes a long time for that to actually heal. And you you actually have to do somewhat of a secondary healing. You can go in there either surgically and put sutures in around that ligament to tighten that joint up. Does that necessarily hold the joint? No, not really. But what happens is with those sutures in there, the scar tissue will be laid around it and actually create support for that joint. And so you can have also fractures of those. Now, that's a different thing, because on the superficial distal muscle attaches on the proximal end of P2, and then the deep distal attaches on P3. And the way that the foot hits, you can get fractures in the middle of P2, you can get fractures of P3, and you can have dislocations of those joints based upon that. It's really very easy to fix. If you say, okay, I've got a fat toe here, my dog seems to be lame, let me take that toe off, you change the whole biomechanics of how that foot hits the surface. And if we're talking a dog that is 2 years old, 3 years old, that paw grew up for 2 years to be designed to work one specific way. And now you've taken that toe off, and you've changed the dynamics of that whole paw. And not only the paw, but how it affects the rest of the proximal limb, the distal limb there. So toes are a huge importance in a lot of breeds, but I think more so in the sighthounds, because we see it. They're really attuned to the dogs, so you pick it up.
Yeah, so I guess amputation then is your absolute last resort, and you want to do everything you can short of that. You mentioned suturing the ligaments there. What other modalities are there to address dislocations?
There So splinting is, I think, probably underutilized. It's kind of interesting, John, if you go through this from a generation standpoint, 50s, 60s, 70s, even to the 80s and part of the 90s, we had a large number of veterinarians who were exposed to racing greyhounds and their various maladies and injuries. And so you had a, when I was coming up through the ranks, I remember in 89, I went down to a Greyhound veterinary conference in West Palm, and all the greats were there, you know, Bloomberg and Taylor and Dee, and they had Jim Gannon over from Australia. And I was just like wide-eyed walking around. Oh my God, here's all these gods of the world that I've always wanted to be part of. And I learned so much from them, but it was really them also, but it was also the group getting together, veterinarians from different parts of Florida or Oregon, all commingling and interacting and discussing different things. I learned many things almost, at the bar later as I did from the lectures. And not that I went to the bar, but I mean, in social gatherings later, we would talk about different things. And there is a salvage, we could call it a salvage procedure, where you can take sodium oreate or ethanol aminoleate and inject it around the joint, not in it, but around it. You splint it for 5 days, you crate rest it for 5 days, you walk it for 5 days, and then you go run it hard. That was kind of an old veterinary treatment that was known amongst the greyhound veterinarians and utilized by them, that I think kind of went away when the numbers of racing greyhounds declined, that there's really not an exposure to that, that type of veterinary knowledge, if you will. You know, totally, for certainly, it's a salvage procedure. My option is to take a toe off. You know, what's my other option? Well, I consulted with a veterinarian in, I think, Florida the other day, said, hey, why don't you put a little suture around that ligament, and that scar tissue will help hold that together, and I think the toe will be fine. And sure enough, it was. It's a pretty easy procedure to go in and put the suture in there. Yeah, this other one's somewhat controversial because it's not, you know, it was first published, I think, in an Australian journal back in 1968, and then brought up a couple more times around there where they would sclerose toes. You know, it's very similar to, what's the one I, there's one where they use 50% dextrose in the human world and do very similar things. But in my opinion, if I can save a toe and leave it on the dog, I would do everything I can to do that as opposed to a lot of the amputations I see going on.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
there's no wrong veterinary decision because the veterinarian has to discuss with the owner what's best for them, and so it's an open discussion. There's really no right or wrong or how do you manage. You have options, and so you can provide the owner with certain options.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I brought several greyhounds to you when you were at Auburn for that very procedure, the sclerosing procedure. And I found that they held quite well in return to performance, probably about 60 to 70% of the time. They weren't 100% successful, but they were successful more than they were not. What was your result?
I guess it's 60%, John, if that's what you're saying.
That's just my dogs. And I don't know if it would have been...
Everybody else was 90%, John. No, I don't.
Because in racing, you know, you're as opposed to lure coursing or amateur racing on grass, you've got a more forgiving surface there for toes, don't you?
That's true. You know, but there's other things you can do nowadays. You know, after working with the sled dogs, I realized I could put sled dog booties on the paw. And so that in a rehabilitation setting, so that the nail and the paw isn't getting grip on the surface. So I've minimized those torsional forces on the digits and it's little tricks like that I may not have known 25 years ago or 20 years ago that I do know now that, certainly the field of veterinary rehabilitation, you know, has certainly moved forward very fast. That's my specialty is veterinary sports medicine rehabilitation. And, I first got introduced to rehabilitation from, Bob Taylor, out at, Denver. He worked at dogs at the Mile High Kennel Club. And I actually, at my little place in my pseudo dog farm there in Kansas City, my wife and I would rehabilitate some dogs there. And that's how I got introduced to rehabilitation. And that field has just exploded in the past 20, 30 years. We created a recognized specialty that was recognized by the AVMA in 2011. And it's grown up since then. It's really, really neat to be part of that.
Yeah. Now, one other thing on performance medicine I wanted to ask you about was the situation where a dog will run more than one time in a day. And that's true in both lure coursing and amateur racing. They'll run at least twice in lure coursing and in amateur racing, they'll run three times, maybe four times. Is the idea of, snacking. In other words, you start with a light meal in the morning and then what do you do in between runs to kind of give them a little boost and to make sure they're not running on an empty tank? I consulted with you about that, and you had some great ideas, which I tried out and which seemed to work. So tell us about that.
60% of the time or 90% of the time?
No, all the time.
All the time. Well, that's a good one then. So first of all, we're dealing with greyhounds, and before I talk about anything related to that, I got to say, we always worried about bloat, you know, and you always have to have that kind of the back of your mind. If I put something that goes into the stomach that could create a pendulous type of situation where it flips. You know, greyhounds can just get nervous in there and something will flip. So I preface anything I say, like the first thing I want to make sure is that, you know, I'm not putting the dog or the greyhound in a scenario where, you know, I could create a bloat situation, right? So now that I got past my, CYA situation there. When you're dealing with snacking, there's a volume thing there. especially if you got multiple events in a day. You really want to make sure on the Friday before, the Thursday before, whatever, that their glycolytic stores are maxed to as much as they can be. And there's two things there. One of them, you can train the system to hold more glycolytic energy. You can also snack to enhance or top off, make sure that it's all there when needed. And then when you go into the event, you can do something in the morning to kind of give a little bit. But post-event, there's a half-hour period where the dog still mentally and physiologically has not stopped running, that you can give a glucose or some sort of energy snack in that time period. And that, because the dog is still in the state of metabolic extremes, if you want to call it, all the cells are ready to receive glucose. And so when you put glucose in there, the muscle still thinks it's running. It still thinks it needs this glucose to keep going. So when you give it in that time period, it'll actually go straight into the muscle cells instead of, to fat or different stores in the body. If you wait till, more than an hour after that, and I'm just estimating a lot of these things, half hour to hour after that, the body's shifting to back to where it's going to try and store that energy instead of let it go to the muscles. So if you want, you can snack after each event, and that helps top off the glucose stores throughout the day. There is some times that you got to understand that there has to be the dog's body, the greyhound as well, is designed to burn fat as an energy source. That's why they're an endurance animal. They typically outrun their prey, even greyhounds. And so you have to have the core sources of energy, the triglycerides and the fats in there as well, because if you go totally on the snack the next day, a lot of times the dog will run deficient. So you need a good base diet to support the snacking that you're doing. But what I found is that this somewhat snacking, if we call it that, with the glucose after each event, say on a Saturday, it'll help you be prepared for the next day and get through the weekend. But it's really kind of a combination of a good, proper diet with the snacking on top of it. Did that kind of address what you were thinking there, John?
Yeah. And so just to make sure the listeners and I have it right, you want to give them that snack within 30 minutes of the completion of the run.
Yeah.
And then what do you think is the best, what's the best snack to give them?
Well, I wouldn't give them soot. you're not going to give them a fat. You got to have something that it has to have something that's almost like a pure glucose. 50% dextrose is one thing. We've out in New Mexico when we were running lurchers out there, I would go into the quick shop and buy Karo syrup. It's kind of basically syrup. There was a time we were putting I think it was like 2 cups of sugar into a gallon of water and creating sugar water. If you give say you give raw meat, the meat goes into the body and has to be digested before it can actually turn into energy. If you give anything with fat, the fat has to go in and be digested and turned into something with energy. When we're talking about snacking, it has to be an immediate energy source. So it has to be really almost like a raw glucose or dextrose, something of that form that allows that energy to go straight from the mouth up through the intestine and straight to the muscle tissues.
Yeah, I can remember putting a little Karo syrup in a bowl and just letting them lick that. And yeah, they were happy to do it. They liked it, and it got it into the system without a lot
sometimes
of bowl.
You can mix it in with some beef broth or chicken broth.
Yeah.
Except you got to watch out for the salt.
Yeah. Well, that's a great tip for all of us that run in sports that require the dog to run more than once in a day. Let's talk, Rob, about what you're doing now in terms of your rehab, your sportsvet.com site and so forth. Tell us about that.
Well, if I want to look up lucky guy in the book, I really would see my picture there because, I've been a very, very lucky person to and be able to fall into a career and a path that I love. And my wife stayed with me through it all. And my she was very supportive of it. My sons were part of all of it. And they've been, you know, they, both my sons, I had them raise one litter of greyhounds so that they would understand what the responsibility of all that is. They've been great. So when I went to the University of Kansas and got that postdoc in performance, it really opened a whole new world of to me that I wouldn't have ever experienced. And then the opportunity to work with the racing greyhound and it's hard for me without, you know, John, getting kind of emotional about how cool my life has been. You know, certainly I've had my ups and downs, and we've all had times where, you know, the greyhounds, I spent more money than we had and hoping for that next little check to come in. And yeah. Diane and I'd say, we need to get another litter. And she goes, no, we need to get no more, you know, and food bills and things like that, that, you know, no one gets into to the greyhounds really, or to the sight hounds or to dog sports really to make money. They get in there really, they have to have some sort of outside money to do it. But, you know, long ago, I was working under Dr. Carol Zebus, my mentor at the University of Kansas, and I learned the proper way to study performance, to study. You know, back then, phones didn't have cameras. I don't know if today's group understands that. We actually had to film greyhounds with 16-millimeter film out of the woodlands in Kansas City. Had to send that off, and it had to get developed. I think it took 3 days to do that. Then I shown that movie down onto a table, and I had a onion skin and a pencil, and I would dot out the movements, and it took weeks to analyze a dog. And nowadays, you know, you can do it in 5-10 minutes. And when I was at Auburn working with the human biomechanics group there, I always threatened that the graduate students should have to go through the pain that I went through. But they all said that that's really too much pain, Rob. They shouldn't have to do that. But so I've continued all along the route, looking at ways to best assess and analyze performance dogs. You know, we did a lot of work with the military. A lot of it applied to different types of breeds out there. We found ways that we could condition and train dogs so that their paws were structured and strong. Found ways to condition and train dogs so that they wouldn't overheat. And all of that's now started flooding into my world. You know, once I got into this world, I learn every day, and I've enjoyed it so much. One of the things that, you know, a while back, I used to give a lot of lameness lectures back in the 1990s, and I used to do a lot of stuff. And I finally, a while back, I put together a little book based on those lectures, basic biomechanics and functional anatomy for the dog owner. It's, you know, I saw a little review on Amazon the other day. It was someone from somewhere that was very highly educated and said this, that the book really was too basic. But when you first open a door into the world of movement, you need to have the basic information. And that's what I prepared this book for, was for people who may not necessarily have a PhD in anatomy or biomechanics. And so that was kind of fun doing that. I'm currently working on an app that can be used on the phone so that you can capture a clip of a dog running, a horse running, whatever. And then you can play it back, analyze it. If you need to check foot angles or whatever, you can do that. I had tried something about 3 years ago, but it was so heavy on the software side that it didn't really work in the tablets or the phones. And I don't know about you, John, your life's probably been perfect all the way, but, you know, I realized I made a mistake there. We need to step back and readdress this. And so I've been working with a group, putting together an app to help analyze dogs. You know, it's so exciting to me. I still get a lot of people contacting me I've ran into so many great people in my career, and we get to keep in touch. And they'll call me up, and whether it's a bird dog that's only working 6 hours and it's supposed to be working 8 hours, or if it's a whippet that doesn't seem to be making the turn like it used to. I love those complex questions. It really taps into my experience, my knowledge base. It tests me. I'm not always right, for sure. But every time I go through that, I learn something new if I'm not right. But we usually figure everything out. And what's cool about it is the people that have these performance or working dogs, greyhound people, sighthound people, whippets, Rhodesian Roachbacks, the Borzois, they're so enthusiastic that it's fun to work with them. You know, that's they'll come into me and they'll tell me all about it. And I don't mind. I mean, I get their enthusiasm. I have the same enthusiasm as well. And so when we work through these things, you know, for me, it's just it's not work. So I've kept my feet in the game, I guess, if you will, and I keep plugging along and enjoying the opportunity to work with athletic working dogs and really, I don't want to, you know, I should say, you know, those greyhounds really got to me early in my career, and so I do have a somewhat of a soft spot for the sighthound in the greyhound world. You know, John, I know one time I'd lost a brood female not too soon before I had come over to talk to you guys, and I hadn't really realized how much it meant to me till I talked to you guys. You know, that emotion's there, and a passion's there, whether it's a greyhound or you know, a military working dog. I get the feel. I just love working with these types of dogs.
Yeah. Now you're currently located in Lancaster, South Carolina. And if somebody wanted to consult with you, would they do it through the sportsvet.com website?
Yeah, if they'd reach out through sportsvet.com caninecaresportsvet.com. We are part of a project that I think I can talk a little bit about where we actually part of a couple of projects. I'm working right now. It's kind of fun. I'm working with a group out of the University of Cape Town in South Africa. They did some work. He's a robotics engineer, and he was looking at how cheetahs run and how they could design robots related to how cheetahs move, or, well, how they could design the robots. And a few years ago, I guess 10 years ago, time flies, we hooked up, and he'd seen the all the videos that I had taken of the greyhounds, and so we started talking how we could maybe partner up. And that right now we're looking at how ways, because there's a way that the dogs run, and it really is exposed to the greyhounds, where there's almost a decoupling of the front end and the back end of the dog in a turn. You know, they run very fluid, but when they go into a turn, it's really interesting. I've realized that all dogs do it, but I didn't pick it up until I started watching the greyhounds. So I've partnered up with this group out of the University of Cape Town, South Africa, because they've developed a way to analyze cheetahs without markers, and it's a six camera system. So I've worked with the local sighthound group here, and we're going to capture some stuff related to that. You know, I keep in touch. I've got a colleague at Michigan State, Dr. Sarah Scholl, that I work with quite a bit. And I work with her. She's a great sports medicine vet. And there's so many other young veterinarians out there that are interested. It's been fun to try to find a way to pass on my knowledge, my errors, my mistakes, along with my successes to help others learn in this field.
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. So you still see clinically see dogs there in Lancaster.
Yep, I can. I have the ability to work with some dogs here.
That's great.
Has to be a veterinary referral.
Yeah. What's the future hold in terms of your projects? Have you got anything kind of on the beginning drawing boards in addition to the robot from the cheetah and the greyhound?
Yeah, actually, I do, and it's a kind of a work of love. You know, I I'm trying to put together an online, you know, they have all these online courses nowadays, and I see books out there and stuff. I'm trying to put together a online course on canine science and performance, or canine performance sciences, for those that might be interested. And I've got the first three classes together on that. It's probably labor of love. It'll come out in the next few months. I'm really kind of excited about that. Cause you know, they got this thing now, John, I don't know if you know, it's called the World Wide Web, and people can talk everywhere all the time. And it's so fun because I now get information or questions from anywhere in the world. And I, you know, there's people like us everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It's so fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, keep up the good work, Rob. It's been a great, time here conversing with you. And also we've had a great relationship over the years. You've done great work on my own personal dogs. So it's been great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. You guys have a great evening. Thank you so much.
Greyhound lovers, we'll be back at the next episode. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Dr. Gillette.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. If you're not a regular listener, be sure to follow Greyhound Nation wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for Grey Nation Show, follow us, and you'll get notifications every time we release a new episode. You can also get new show notifications when you subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you like the episode, leave us a review on our Facebook page or your favorite podcast app. You can also send us feedback or questions via the contact form on our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. This episode was produced in collaboration with host John Parker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dimitri Taras. We wanted to say thanks to Dr. Rob Gillette for joining us on the show today. You can learn more about his research in greyhound sports medicine at his website, sportsvet.com. If you'd like a consult for your greyhound, reach out via the website or send an email to caninecare@sportsvet.com. Finally, you can find his book, Athletic and Working Dog, Functional Anatomy and Biomechanics, on Amazon.com. I'm Michael Burns, and you've been listening to Greyhound Nation.